Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
All righty, hello everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a seasoned founder, you know, a founder that has done it, you know, before, a founder that has worked with some of the biggest names that you can think of. And we're definitely going to be touching on the building, the scaling, the financing, all of that good stuff that we like to hear. But also, you know, other relevant topics, you know, like walking away from a salary that pays very well, or why, you know, you get going, you know, to begin with, or perhaps how to figure out a business model that is faster and cheaper than perhaps the other people that are really competing directly or indirectly, or let's say, you know, the funding cycles, right? I mean, we've seen a lot, you know, with the markets up and down with COVID, you know, lately. So I think it's quite a timely conversation. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Mary Lou Jepson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to spend this time with you.
So originally born in a farm in Connecticut, how was life growing up for you?
Learned how to build stuff for sure and, you know, get dirty, get your hands dirty. Also rebuilt car engines and I started test driving submarines for my high school job, had a security clearance, did lots of stuff like that, but really loved math and art and learned how to build stuff, which has served me well in doing engineering and entrepreneurship.
Well, I guess that's where the love for math and, you know, and the creative, you know, in you, you know, perhaps that thing came about. You eventually got into Brown, but I know that MIT, a university that, you know, a school that you've definitely been, you know, very close to.
Yeah, I got a degree from Brown and then I did some graduate work. I did a master's degree at the MIT Media Lab as it was starting up in the 80s.
So you became a professor, you know, as well. So why
a professor? I came back in the mid-2000s as a professor there. I did my master's degree and co-created the world's first holographic video system. So VR, but without having to wear something on your head and just in thin air projecting video into a room by computing both the phase and interference of light. So that was a tough project. A lot of people thought it was impossible. We got it done.
Basically, in your case, when you were, you know, doing this, definitely one thing that that really gave you perspective and changed things was an illness, you know, that got you into a wheelchair. I think that that kind of like altered the way that you were going about things, the way that you were thinking, you know, maybe about doing a PhD as well. So what happened?
As a child, I was sick and often hospitalized and with unknown diseases. And it became progressively worse in my 20s. And as I was doing a PhD, to the point where I had to drop out. But even when I spent several months when I was in 13, a lot of people thought I would die. They called my parents and told them I was dead. They made a mistake. But that was quite a shakeup for the family. Luckily, they got the wrong girl. But, you know, the thing is, I just decided then it sort of takes you off the track of this whatever social thing you're supposed to be. And I just wanted to live before I died. And I, you know, you get off of the rules of what you should do, be, wear, what color, whatever clothes, lip gloss you're supposed to wear, all that crap from teenager, you know, dumb. And so I just focused on doing math and art. And kept going. But yes, I was in a wheelchair sleeping 20 hours a day, body full of sores, couldn't move half my face. And then the worst thing happened. I was doing a PhD in physics at Brown University. I'd come back and with my same professor from undergrad to do a PhD there. I could no longer subtract. I didn't think I deserved a PhD in physics. I didn't tell anybody I couldn't subtract. I thought that was written, like there's no way they could look in my mind and know. But I was utterly defeated. Called up my parents, asked them if I could have a room at their house and go home and die because no one could figure out what I had. I was at Brown University. There was a med school there. They let me see the professors. No one could diagnose my condition. So that seemed like it would be kaputs again in my life. But luckily, one of the professors said, you have really these blistering headaches. Maybe you should have an MRI. This is 1995. MRI was not standard of care then. Luckily, he paid for it. I didn't know I needed it. They found the brain tumor. I got it removed. I petitioned to get back into grad school using the I had a brain tumor excuse. That worked. I got the empathy vote. But for the rest of my life, I've taken a dozen medications every day or I'll die. So I still focus on, we're alive now. What do you want to do? So try, not every day, but I try to be productive and impactful as I can.
Well, without a doubt, I'm sure that that thing gave you a ton of perspective and definitely changed the course and the direction for you. And in fact, after this event, you got a bunch of money and you started your first company. So how did that come about?
Yeah. So with two other students, they were at MIT, but I had been at MIT. I had a close relationship. We got a $4 million grant from DARPA if we would commercialize together our PhD research. So we started a company, moved to Silicon Valley and off and running. And then we got, you know, Series A from, you know, Sand Hill Road, August Capital, others. And we're shipping in a few years. So these liquid crystalline silicon devices that were little tiny screens, but they were HDTV screens in a chip that we were selling for $20. It was going into virtual reality headsets, Qualcomm smartphones, rear projection systems that were really thin, some that were thick, Pico projectors, all these kinds of things that weren't possible until that moment, going into laptops, going into all different types of things as a way to get to low-cost next-generation screen technology. So we did a really great job at that.
Now, after 8 years there, you decided it's time to turn page. So how did that come about, too, and what was the lesson to be learned?
Yeah. So Intel recruited me as a CTO of their display division. And I had some creative differences with a string of CEOs. I was the CTO, Chunk Technology, and creative differences with the CEO who I felt was making not such great decisions. But what did I know? You know, so anyway, I joined Intel back when Intel was Intel. And they made me chief technology officer of the display division, where we were using Intel silicon to make liquid crystal on silicon devices with the force of Intel behind it. When we announced it at CES that year in 2004, it raised the market cap by billions of dollars. It was a big splash for Intel to enter into this.
So then with this, you know, you eventually, I mean, like we said, you know, MIT, you know, has been there, you know, all along the way. But eventually, you know, you decided to go at it again. I mean, as they say, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. And you went at it with one laptop per child.
Yes. I went back to MIT to become a professor. I ran into the CEO in an elevator. The main building's only four floors, but it only took me two sentences to explain why Intel Silicon can never work for screens. He said, come into my office, close the division. I saved him hundreds of millions of dollars. Everybody was mad at me. But it was never going to work. It was my job to speak truth to power. I would utterly collapse, decided I should never do companies again, got that PhD and applied for jobs as a professor, got one. And in the final interview for it, started One Laptop Per Child, which became a billion-dollar not-for-profit, fastest growing consumer electronic category ever recorded. Started that with the founder of the MIT Media Lab, much more, you know, well-known, Nicholas Negroponte. And he taught me how to become a CEO for sure. I spent more time with him in the next 3 years than any other human being as we somehow like created this fastest growing consumer electronic product that could transform the lives of kids in the developing world out of nothing but hard work.
Well, you eventually left that and then all of a sudden you find yourself in China.
Oh yeah, I left that because the laptop was done and it made sense, I thought, to, you know, give the baton to the next person, because the challenge that from this thing everybody laughed about and thought was a joke that was now shipping, every project I've ever done in any worth, everybody has always thought it was hysterical when I started and ridiculous and unbelievable and impossible. And like, just aside, what actually would be helpful when you're telling somebody that is why, what are the reasons underneath? Because maybe you know something they don't know and then they can correct. But anyway, so it shipped. But I thought an early childhood education expert, particularly in the developing world, would be a good person to take my position. And I wanted to keep pushing the envelope on really innovative hardware, as we'd shown with that $100 laptop. It wasn't a stripped down laptop. It hasn't been matched in many ways in terms of the technology and the ability of all the things that we created in it. And I can explain it, but it might be a side point.
Well, I like to hear what happened with China, because I mean, that obviously changed the course of things, you know, with your next business, you know, which ultimately led you to Google.
I've been traveling to China and shipping with Korea and Japan and Taiwan and mainland China and Hong Kong, Singapore since 95. We're now in 2008. I had 13 years of experience under my belt, but now I had access to the $10 billion factories of Asia and had co-created the fastest growing consumer electronic category ever recorded in the netbook. So I had some sachet I didn't have before and ability to work with them and give them what they need. So I thought the best use of me was letting go of the fabulous fabs at MIT that, you know, honestly, a postdoc can make some device once and then it might take another year with the contamination, whatever, to get the thing going. You work with a factory and pick the country, Japan, China, whatever. They make one, 3 months later, they can make a million. That's interesting, but then you got to make a business. But you can move the needle so much faster if you use these processes. I mean, 2 nanometer is on one place, one factory in Taiwan, right? That's the place. It's not really anywhere else if you want to do high quality manufacturing. And that's really what I wanted to do. So I then slept on the factory floors of Asia. I already had been doing that, just a lot more of it. I didn't really mean to. I had, you know, the company was also based in San Francisco, but I moved to Asia during that. It was 2008. There was a financial crisis. I got Series A funding in Q4 2008. I think I'm the only one that did so. So it of any startup that I'm aware of, the lights were on at the venture capital companies on Sand Hill Road. The drinks were free in the fridge, but they weren't writing checks. So to come off of something like that, I mean, Time Magazine made me one of the 100 most influential people in the world, invited me to their party. And it was like pretty heady stuff. And it was all for naught because all of a sudden no one cared because, I mean, the sky really did fall in Q3 2008, if you remember.
Well, I mean, in the end, you ended up going through an acquisition with Google and obviously working directly with Sergey. So how was it like, one of the co-founders there? So how was it like going through a transaction, you know, for you, like going through an acquisition, you know, especially at this point, you know, you were the CEO of the company too. So, you know, now you have gone from like the technical level that you were used to now leading the reins and also leading a transaction of that nature.
Well, it's very interesting because they were starting and I pitched to Sergey the same thing I pitched when I wanted to join the Media Lab, Brain Computer Interface. I thought we could do it in 2004. We probably could have. I just realized I could make a $100 laptop faster. So did that. Pitched it to Sergey. Sergey loved it and wanted to buy the company. The company purchase didn't go through. This is 2012. And so finally, we made a deal where I would jump. I had founded Pixel Chi, that company after One Laptop Per Child. That was the name of it, with my husband. So my husband would stay in Taiwan. I would sort of go to Google. But somehow they thought I was Pixel Chi. And I needed a team around me. And so we started contracting with them. And eventually Google let me acqui-hire them. They let me buy actually another company too, even though we weren't supposed to do anything outside of Mountain View. I did make the argument that we're going to do consumer electronics. It's kind of expensive to build a factory in Mountain View, California. So anyway, I was allowed to eventually, as I gained trust, to bring in the team and acqui-hire them and also bring in a couple of other organizations to enable us to scale what we were doing at Google X in consumer electronics that could be rapidly designed and rapidly move the needle on projects that Google, that Larry Sergey and Eric Schmidt, who was still there, really wanted to have happen.
So eventually you also, I mean, it's amazing because all of a sudden you find yourself working with some of the biggest names. I mean, Sergey, Eric Schmidt, as you were pointing to, or Larry, but then also Mark Zuckerberg. How does Mark Zuckerberg get into the picture?
He buys this company called Oculus. Young Palmer Luckey got everyone excited about VR again. And he buys it for a few billion dollars. I think Palmer's like 21 at that time. He's wonderful, amazing. He's got another gazillion-dollar company now called Anduril that's doing really interesting stuff. and certainly, so he bought that. He really wanted VR. He loved VR. Clearly changed the name of the company to Meta because he loves it so much. He's invested $100 billion into it over the last decade. It's astonishing. I didn't actually understand that he would do all that. But they were looking for somebody, since that team was really good at gaming. Like, they had John Carmack, who, you know, look at the top software programmers in the world, the top 10 individuals. He's always somewhere on that list. He wrote like major video games in the 90s, basically single-handedly. Anyway, they had people like him, but they didn't have anybody that had shipped at scale devices that were distinguished by the screen and the optics in creative ways in what we needed to do for next generation high fidelity VR and AR. No one wants to wear a shoebox on your face. It's not, I mean, it's fine that they, you know, did it pretty well on the Oculus Quest 1 and Quest 2 is better. But, you know, where we were really directionally going is to either nothing, or there's one thing that's acceptable to wear on your face. I'm wearing it as a pair of eyeglasses. I don't have to charge it up, et cetera, et cetera. Like, that's what's acceptable socially. I had seen what had happened with Google Glass. I mean, you got a product problem when you're called a glass hole thing. So, you know, there's also social issues. So anyway, so I helped them a lot with that, with things that I think are finally coming to light. The sunglasses VR AR toggle with extraordinary fidelity and field of view, but also a lot of me is in the Oculus Quest 2. But, you know, when you now have so many people involved, and, you know, frankly, people that didn't understand even the technology and didn't care to understand it, they really wanted their positions. I got it. It's a large company. I know, like, you got to do these things. But at some point, you know, I did what I could. And I said, you know, like, whatever. I love startups because they're small, trusted teams that develop this extraordinary trust. In large organizations, moving the mindset of it is slog. And so at Google, at Facebook, and, you know, at Intel, there were these huge barriers because we always did it that way. Like, at Intel, they had ratifications committees, con ratification committees, because whatever, you get a bit wrong, Wells Fargo loses $1 billion. They had to do it. But in a new business initiative where it doesn't really matter if you get a bit wrong on a screen, like, you didn't really need to do that. So a lot of this stuff, particularly at Facebook at that time, it was a younger company. Really, the executives in charge were excellent at optimizing click-through revenue for ad sales. Because let's face it, that's what's made the money in technology, social media, et cetera. You know, I just got frustrated with the decision-making. And I just, you know, I just like, whatever, there's enough people. Mark's going to spend enough money. It shouldn't be me that has to point out that $100 billion to get to where they've gotten was not efficient spending of the money.
Hey, guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
You also had the entrepreneur in you. So it was just a matter of time until you got started with your next thing, which ended up becoming Open Water.
I love VR and AR. I do. And getting rid of all of that. And I still am working on that on my own, but not VR and AR. But I think everybody wants a million-dollar view. In pandemic, as you know, I do a lot of art. So I'm working on an art project to just give everyone a million-dollar view with screens that are literally about $20 a square foot, LCD screens, because screens happened, and with amorphous silicon. And just you have it 3D, and you take the content, and you're able then to feel like you're anywhere, over the Eiffel Tower, looking at the Golden Gate Bridge, on the moon, wherever. And it can give, because especially in pandemic, people move to have a more beautiful place to live. What if you could just put that in and not 2D, but like feel like you're in the space and have it move and react and be correct in the lighting and all of that. We have all the footage. It's easy to do. So anyway, I had some differences of opinion, as usual, like that. But I just thought that what really everybody thought was nuts when I tried to convince Sergey to do this, when I tried to convince Intel, MIT, and Mark, they said, great. And then they said, well, we really need you to do this. And that's true. They really did need you to do this. But I felt, especially like now that I had some money, somebody has to try this. Why not me? Because I really deeply think that it's possible by modulating the phase of infrared light that penetrates our body, ultrasound and electromagnetics, to fundamentally selectively treat cells at a cellular level, cancer cells, not healthy tissue, turn on and off neurons, senescent cells, stem cells, deactivate pathogens, and so forth. So that was hard to get funding for, because that sounds, you know, stark raving, which is why I think you can do it. But I started, it was easy for me with my track record to get funding for it. Seed funding was easy. People were competing. I self-funded for a while, and then they just kept calling and like very famous names. And, you know, I picked some. Series A was relatively easy, but the R&D for this was hard and it took a while. And in medical devices, it takes a while to ship because you need FDA approval. And there was a comprehensive paper published 2 years ago of every complex new therapeutic medical device that's gotten regulatory approval in the last 30 years, translated into $2024. And the summary is $700 million capitalized cost in 13 years. That's the problem with improving healthcare. And that's why we have these 20 to 40 year moats where the expenses stay high. The MRI machine that saved my life in 1995, is that better, faster, or cheaper? No, same price. It's actually more expensive. It's now a profit center for hospitals. It's about 10 times more expensive because they get 90% gross margin on it. Where before it was standard of care, they didn't do that. They were trying to get it into the system. And so you look at the system, and like literally this week, we had a headline in the Wall Street Journal saying, aren't we justified in murdering healthcare CEOs? I think absolutely not. I was just really surprised. What we have to do is make it better, faster, and cheaper. And what we're doing at Open Water and our results in the clinic so far are astonishing. We are curing mice of glioblastoma, 100% deadly form of human brain cancer. But not the implications aren't just on glioblastoma. It's all aggressive cancers, because they all have a mechanical property that we can exploit. They have a huge nucleus, small cytoplasm. We can exploit that like an opera singer can ping a wine glass, match the note that she hears, and destroy the wine glass and harm nothing else in the room. It is literally what we're doing with cancer cells. We change the frequency. We're turning on and off neurons and taking people with severe treatment-resistant depression out of it. Almost half of the people in our first study came out of it, because you can see the signature of the overfiring neurons from depression, almost like you can see a tumor in an MRI. You see them, but by focusing ultrasound on them. These are diagnostic levels of ultrasound proven safe for 100 years on billions of people, including the last 50 years on pregnant women and their fetuses in the rich countries.
So let me ask you this, you know, as you're talking about this, if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Open Water is fully realized, what does that look like?
Hospitals are over. Healthcare costs go down. They're right now 25% of our economy in the U.S. We can't keep doubling. well, actually, it can double one more time, then it's existential. So we fix that. And we learn more about biology than ever before possible because we create basically something like the smartphone. So we live in a world where people are trying to create these, but they're big. And they're about a million, it takes whatever. By the time you get approval and reimbursement, it's about $1.5 billion for a new device. You do a single rare disease. What do you charge for it? 5,000 people have that disease. $1 million of treatment. That's the world we live in right now. The problem is $700 million in 13 years. The problem for drugs is 26 years and $3 billion. And so if you're going to make a company that moves the needle on healthcare, you have to figure out how to move it fast. And so for that, I open sourced the company, which made my investors crazy because they yelled at me because they thought open source was a synonym for a charity. I'm like, no, free as in speech, not free as in beer, et cetera, et cetera. But by open sourcing it, when you look at the cost of what that $700 million is in those 13 years, 85% of that capitalized cost is the device development. 7% is safety, and then the rest. And since you're paying this compound interest of 8% a year, there's a non-linearity to it, we can reduce the approval cost to $1 to $5 million in 1 to 2 years. That's all of a sudden fundable by existing mechanisms like venture capital, like a lot of different things. And so by making this platform, since we have a platform of being able, we've made ultrasound so you can sort of pick any note over many octaves in any rhythm. We also have a very beautiful thing that sees blood flow 20 times more accurately than by some measures than a multi-million dollar MRI using $1 camera chips and a smartphone and a laser that was a pain to design, but I've got it here now. It's a diode laser that's this size that's going into production right now. So that allows us to do things like see blood flow for stroke, which is the number two killer in the world and is a time to diagnosis issue. So this is this laser that works with 8 smartphone chips, and this laser allows us to take holograms of the body. And so we see the, what we take the lenses off the camera chips, and what we see are, look like waves on the ocean, and we read those waves like a sailor can read the waves on the ocean and know where the fish are, where the land is. We know whether you're having a stroke or not, according to, we did a 2 years of study at University of Pennsylvania and Brown University, nothing to do with my relationship there. Literally, there's a guy there that changed the standard of care for stroke with 1 year and one paper. That's why we worked with him. Amazing, because we want to change things fast. And so how do you speed things up? You work with everybody else that wants to do it fast and just do it fast. So we're making these things, and this is the system for the head, but we're also working on pathogen deactivation and amyloid microclot removal, which is a hallmark of neurodegenerative disease, long COVID, diabetes.
Well, I mean, if you guys are able to execute on this, it sounds like a beautiful world, right? You know, the vision being realized. I guess, obviously, for this too, it sounds like it's capital intensive as well, right? I mean, you guys have raised about $100 million.
We've got $48 million in the bank right now, 8-year-old company.
Which is amazing.
Start the company. But we're scaling up to ship these in the very factories that make our smartphones and laptops, the ones I've lived and breathed in for 30 years now.
That's amazing.
So good relationships with them. Great team, by the way. Incredible team on hardware in particularly. But the thing is, rather than going for a single rare disease of a few thousand people and it taking, 13 to 20 years by the time you get a reimbursement, and spending $1.5 billion, $1 billion. What do you charge for it? $1 million a piece. If this is good for so many different diseases, you sell millions of them. You make $100 a device. It's a lot more money and it's a lot faster. It's a much better business and it's much better for the world than business as usual in healthcare. With a 20 to 40, you don't need a 20 to 40 year moat. It's like healthcare is anti-innovation. And the very thing that kills us, that kills 55 million people a year, more than wars, is anti-innovation. And structurally, what you have to do is get more data. A regulatory agency, FDA or whatever, pick the country. And we're working with lots of different countries. Countries will own their own approvals. No drug shortages. This transcends drugs. So what do you need drugs for when you can selectively kill a cancer cell like an opera singer with a wine glass, or turn on and off neurons exactly where they're overfiring, stimulate stem cells, deactivate, you know, pathogens wherever they are, or amyloid? Right, so all of this is in research. None of it is FDA approved, but we're shipping the devices as R&D. You can get them on our website now and start your approval process. So, and we are helping by, we have requested everybody share safety data because you benefit from that. If you share safety data across all the trials, we should be in 100 clinical trials next year, which is for scale more than CRISPR, which won the Nobel Prize and everybody's heard of. 100 clinical trials. What is a regulator going to do with 100 times more data than they've ever had before? Will that make it easier or harder to approve the risk factor of the device? And what's a doctor and patient going to do with 100 times more data than they've had before? We make money. We make a lot more money than the other way. But we, in the limit, as we approach this, can save a lot more people too. And it just surprises me, like silicon and software and open source have changed every other industry in the last 30 years, but somehow they've been blocked from healthcare. So us are coming in.
And obviously lots of lessons learned along the way too. And I wanna touch on that, you know, real quick. If I was to put you into a time machine and I was to bring you back to the 90s, you know, to that moment where you were getting started with your first day baby, with your first company, and you had the opportunity of seeing that younger self and being able to give that younger self one piece of advice before launching a company, what would that be and why, given what you know now?
I didn't plan to be an entrepreneur. It just became the fastest way to get things done and have impact. I think those early years, getting very good at, and very deep dives in a variety of technology, can make you so much better when you take that entrepreneur journey, especially if you do tech, because you have to understand the tech, not just what people tell you the limits are. And so I think that's very important. Elon says first principles, and I'm like, well, first principles in science, that's Aristotle. In Oxford, it was banned for you to deviate from Aristotelian thought, which is why like Newton and Galileo, they were not at Oxford. So I wouldn't say first principles, but like many principles, and find what people dismissed before. But you can't do that without deeply understanding the schools of thought and innovating yourself, I think, in technology. But then you have to grow up and let go of it and hire people better than you in the interesting areas that they can go deep in. That's another problem. So the one thing would probably be do the deep dives, get really good until you're about 25, then do the startup. Maybe around that. Don't wait too long.
That's amazing, Mary. For the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, and then also to learn more about what you guys are doing, what is the best way for them to do so?
Community@openwater.health, community site, or join our Discord channel, which is openwater.health.
Amazing. Well, hey, well, easy enough. Well, Mary, thank you so much for being on the Deal Maker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you very much. It's great. Huge fan of the show. Learn a lot. Thank you.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.